Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. Thank you, choir. Sometime Barb will have to think about trying to remember to put the words in. I could understand the words wonderfully, perfectly, but the words were great. And I do not have a program, so I don't know what we're doing. But I could guess. Prairie prides itself on many things, including being a very welcoming place, no matter where you are on this journey of life. And there was that line in what the choir just sang about mystery of life, living in that. No matter the color of your skin, no matter your ethnicity, your gender, your sexual orientation, your abilities or disabilities, you are welcome here. We do urge you, if this is one of your first times, to try us out more than once, because our services are different every Sunday. Sometimes I do the service. I am Sandy Ingham, the minister here. Sometimes people from within the congregation do the service, and sometimes folks from outside do it. The opening words, then, are those of Ann Pert. We come together to celebrate who we are, to share the insights that give meaning and hope to our lives, to learn from the wisdom of others, that their truths may contribute to our understanding. We light our flaming chalice to illuminate the world we seek. In the search for truth, may we be just. In the search for justice, may we be loving. And in loving, may we find peace. This reading is from Nicholas Carr's book, The Glass Cage, which I am drawing heavily upon this morning. It's from a chapter titled Your Inner Drone. Carr writes, "It's a cold, misty Friday night in mid-December, and you're driving home from your office holiday party. Actually, you're being driven home. You recently bought your first autonomous car, a Google-programmed, Mercedes-built, e-smart electric sedan, and the software is at the wheel. You can see from the glare of your self-adjusting LED headlights that the street is icy in spots. And you know, thanks to the continuously updated dashboard display, that the car is adjusting its speed and traction settings accordingly. All's going smoothly. You relax and let your mind drift back to the evening's stilted festivities. But as you pass through a densely wooded stretch of road, just a few hundred yards from your driveway, an animal darts into the street and freezes directly in the path of the car. It's your neighbor's beagle, you realize, the one that's always getting loose. What does your robot driver do? Does it slam on the brakes in hopes of saving the dog, but at the risk of sending the car into an uncontrolled skid? Or does it keep its virtual foot off the brake, sacrificing the beagle to ensure that you and your vehicle stay out of harm's way? How does it sort through and weigh the variables and the probabilities to arrive at a split-second decision? If its algorithms calculate that hitting the brakes would give the dog a 53% chance of survival, but would entail an 18% chance of damaging the car and a 4% chance of causing injury to you, does it conclude that trying to save the animal would be the right thing to do? How does the software, working on its own, translate a set of numbers into a decision that has both practical and moral consequences? What if the animal in the road isn't your neighbor's dog, but your own? What, for that matter, if it isn't a dog, but a child? Imagine you're on your morning commute, scrolling through your overnight emails as your self-driving car crosses a bridge. Its speed precisely synced to the 40-mile-per-hour limit. A group of school children is also heading over the bridge on the pedestrian walkway that runs alongside your lane. The kids, watched by adults, seem orderly and well-behaved. There's no sign of trouble, but your car slows slightly, its computer preferring to err on the side of safety. Suddenly, there's a tussle, and a little boy is pushed into the road. Busily tapping out a message on your smartphone, you're oblivious to what's happening. Your car has to make the decision. Either it swerves out of its lane and goes off the opposite side of the bridge, possibly killing you, or it hits a child. What does the program, what does the software instruct the steering wheel to do? Would the program make a different choice if it knew that one of your own children was riding with you, strapped into a sensor-equipped car seat in the back? What if there was an oncoming vehicle in the other lane? And what if that vehicle was a school bus? Isaac Asimov's first law of robot ethics. A robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. Sounds reasonable and reassuring, but it assumes a world far simpler than our own. Driving along Midvale on my way to Prairie a couple of weeks ago, I noticed that the car in front of me was behaving strangely. The car in the left-hand lane kept straying into the right-hand lane. Odd, thought I, and too early in the day, probably, for a drunk driver situation. It was only 9 a.m. I finally decided that the best thing for me to do was either drop way back or go around the car, but since I'm always late, I opted to zip by on the right. After honking my horn, I'd already honked my horn once or twice at the light where it just sat there, but the driver had not looked up or looked at me. The driver, a female, in her, I'd say, maybe 20s or 30s, was texting. One of my pet peeves. Other screen-related behaviors that annoy me: seeing a table full of people in a restaurant where every single person is staring at a screen. Hiking in a beautiful, out-of-the-way place and having that solitude interrupted by someone talking on a cell phone. Customers in stores and coffee shops yakking away on phones or texting while an employee is trying to take their order or their money. Now, these are minor aggravations, and I don't notice them every day, nor do I dwell on them. Of much greater concern to me, when I observe so many people looking at their screens and being oblivious to what is going on around them, my main concern is, where are we humans, going? What will happen to our minds as we continue to use them less and less? What will happen to our ability to solve problems without the aid of apps? What will happen to our imagination as computers do more and more? What will happen to creativity and memory and joy? What will happen to the pursuit of gathering knowledge and learning skills and the pleasure and satisfaction in work well done? If no one writes letters anymore, I do, what will happen to the art of writing memoirs and biographies? What will happen to originality if children mostly interact with screens and not with each other? Now, email messages have no breadth or width or depth to them. And as for children, well, I saw an article in a newspaper, remember them, recently. Yes, I still read newspapers too. With this headline: by age two, most kids can navigate touchscreens. It was, I think, an objective, balanced article, emphasizing the fact that it's too early to know what this means. Whether this is good or bad for child development remains to be seen, the writer, Lisa Rappaport, said. One pediatrics researcher said that this will partly depend on how much the technology helps kids engage with the world around them. A doctor commented that screen time should not take time away from play involving people. Two important points, I think, come out here in this article about computer use. It cannot take the place of, one, engaging in the world, and two, interacting with people. Now, before I get any deeper into this subject, I should tell you that my reflections this morning are not intended to be a rant against technology in general, nor a condemnation of computers and electronic devices in particular. I'm not advocating a return to living in caves or giving up every modern convenience. I like electricity, for example. There is a time and a place for computers and satellite navigation systems and cell phones and all of that. My concern is that we are increasingly lax about asking the question, to what end, where new technology is concerned. We seem oblivious to, or maybe totally uncaring about, what these two words mean, human being. As journalist Nicholas Carr says, technology has always challenged people to think about what's important in their lives, to ask themselves what human being means, but automation raises the stakes. To resist invention is not to reject invention, it's to humble invention, Carr says, to bring it down to earth. If the source of our vitality is, as Emerson taught us, the active soul, then our highest obligation is to resist anything that would enfeeble that soul. Automation severs ends from means. It makes getting what we want easier, but it distances us from the work of knowing. The aim is joy. And although I have been accused of being a Luddite, some of you may not know what a Luddite is. They were a group of early 19th century English workmen, mainly at the beginning in the textile industries, engaged in, to quote from the dictionary, attempting to prevent the use of labor-saving machinery by destroying it. They were a bit radical. So I have been accused of being a Luddite, and I sympathize with the Luddites. But I'm not a true believer because I would not do away with all technology, nor would I use violence, hopefully. I don't have a smartphone. I don't have any desire for one. I like my little dumb phone. I don't even have a computer at home. I don't own an iPad or a tablet. I don't tweet or Twitter or text or any of those T things. I'm not on Facebook and I have little interest in it. I do know what apps are and think that many of them are ridiculous. I do know what a GPS is, but for me, it is much more challenging and fun to figure out on my own where I'm going. More about that in a few minutes. I also know what friendship is and what the true meaning of the word friend is. I know the immense value of telling our stories and of listening to other people's stories one-on-one, not through social media. I know that real deep connections are made that way, face-to-face, and in places like this. We read screens all day, not stories, Mark Leibovitz wrote in a recent New York Times Magazine essay. So imagine my surprise, my delight, my relief even, upon discovering that I'm not the only person who feels and thinks this way. There are entire books written on this subject. There are scientists and journalists, psychologists, philosophers, social workers, pediatricians, and so many, many, many people working on the long-term, unforeseen effects of too much reliance on computers, too much screen time. And as I referred to Nicholas Carr earlier, he's the author of The Glass Cage, How Our Computers Are Changing Us. In this book, which was published in 2014, he expresses many of the fears and concerns that I have about what will happen to humanity as computers perform an increasing number of our tasks and our daily chores, not to mention our jobs. Here's a tale of three airplane incidents, all of which occurred in 2009. On February 12th, 2009, Continental Connection commuter flight from Newark, New Jersey was on its way to Buffalo, an hour-long trip. After takeoff, during which the captain manned the controls, he put the plane on autopilot. We know that the captain and the first officer then spent their time chatting about nothing. It was a short flight. Maybe they were bored. As the plane approached the Buffalo airport, the control yoke started shuddering, and the autopilot disconnected. It's supposed to do that. The captain took over. I hope nobody's flying in the near future. The captain took over the manual controls, but he did exactly the opposite of what he should have done. He was so startled that the autopilot had shut off, he couldn't get his bearings. Well, the plane crashed into a house, killing everyone on board and one person on the ground. There were no mechanical problems. There were no physical problems with the pilots. They were healthy and well, but the two did not have time to adjust to the situation. Pilot error was the official cause of the accident. The crew seemed startled, confused, and seemed to lack situational awareness in this emergency. In other words, the two crew members weren't paying attention. On May 31st, 2009, about 3.5 months later, an Air France Airbus left Rio de Janeiro for Paris and encountered a storm over the Atlantic about 3 hours out of Rio. Ice caused the airspeed indicators to give false information, and the autopilot disengaged, which it was supposed to do. Again, the co-pilot did the opposite of what he should have done. He seemed to be bewildered. It's a word used in the official report. Confused. The airspeed indicators did start to work again, so the crew had accurate readings, but the co-pilot kept doing the wrong thing. The plane crashed, killing everyone on board. French investigators said that the crew had a total loss of cognitive control of the situation. Quote. This sounds eerily similar to many of the texting while driving stories I have heard. The third airplane story happened in early 2009, a few weeks before that Continental crash in Buffalo. This was a U.S. Airways flight leaving LaGuardia. It hit a gaggle of geese and lost all its engine power. You'll remember this story because it had a happy ending and because it has a Wisconsin connection. Captain Sullenberger and First Officer Skiles acted calmly. I forget which one of them's from Wisconsin. Skiles, that's what I thought. They acted calmly. See, the plane wasn't on autopilot yet. They acted calmly, quickly, and they landed that plane in the Hudson River, where, as we know, everyone was safely rescued. This crew was operating, except the geese, yes. This crew was operating hands-on, or as close to hands-on as an airplane crew gets these days. They were paying attention. Many years ago, I took the ground school part of learning how to fly. I know how to take off. I don't know how to land. Seemed important. So I ran out of money. But in the ground school part, over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, the instructor drilled into us the necessity of redundancy. Even if you're never going to be certified IFR, who flies? Instrument? Flight rating? Even if you're only going to stick to VFR, visual flight rating, you had to know even if you weren't intending to go on and be instrument rated, you had to know what to do manually if the instruments, the technology, failed. Nicholas Carr uses these airplane stories to illustrate the dangers of relying too much on computers, on automation. He uses the terms automation complacency and automation bias. And he gives us examples of each. The automation complacency is when a computer lulls us into a false sense of security. Here's a minor, not terribly important example. Spell checkers make us much poorer proofreaders. But it's an illustration of what happens with automation complacency. We have a tendency to tune out and become completely unaware of what is going on around us. Well, here's a not so minor example. A cruise ship called the Royal Majesty, way back in 1995, was cruising along, and its state-of-the-art GPS system failed. So it was sending out incorrect readings where the ship was. Crew members weren't paying any attention to the around them. They ignored real-time physical evidence of their location, assuming that the GPS had to be correct. Well, the ship was 20 miles off course, and it ended up running into a sandbar. No one was hurt in this, but there were millions of dollars in damages. Investigators said that, quote, automation complacency, unquote, caused the accident, and that the crew was overly reliant on the automated system, ignoring other navigation aids and lookout information. Automation bias is related to this. When people give undue weight to the information coming through their monitors, even when the information is wrong or misleading, they believe it. Automation bias often causes us to ignore or dismiss other sources of information, including our own senses, such as following a digital mapping instruction without question, ignoring road signs and other clues that might not agree with the GPS. I have a personal example. I was once, this is so embarrassing, 1 hour late for a wedding. The wedding was out in the middle of nowhere, somewhere near Ripon and up in that area. The rehearsal had not been at the same place where the wedding was going to be, so this had never happened to me before. I went to MapQuest. They'd sent me the wrong way. That was bad. Although the couple didn't seem bothered. The father of the groom, I think, was ready to, I don't know what. But here's a more dangerous example. A bus driver in Seattle in 2008 drove his 12-foot-high bus, which happened to be full of high school athletes, into a bridge that had a 9-foot clearance. No one was killed, but 21 students were injured. Well, the driver said he was following the GPS directions and, quote, did not see, unquote, the signs and flashing lights warning about the low bridge. Automation complacency and automation bias have this in common. They get worse as automated systems get more sophisticated. And they always interfere with our ability to pay attention. And most of you have heard me, been interacting with me long enough to know that one of my recurring themes is the importance of paying attention, being aware, being awake, just plain being, very Buddhist. Tap into your Buddhist self. Well, this would seem to imply that we need to be actors in our lives, not observers. Automation reverses this. 4 or 5 years ago, my sister and I volunteered to be the designated drivers for my daughter and two of her friends who were hiking from the south rim of Grand Canyon to the north rim. Now, these weren't young women. Don't ever tell them I said that. They were probably in their mid-40s. This was a wonderful experience. I mean, oh, my poor sister, poor me. We got to spend 3 days at the north rim, waiting for them, of course. We were delighted to be doing this favor. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever made that trip from Jacob Lake, Arizona. Jacob Lake's about 40 miles outside of the entrance to the North Rim, to Cameron, and then back into Grand Canyon Park on the south side this time. This journey takes you past the Vermilion Cliffs, unbelievable, and through Navajo territory, not too far from Lake Powell. Gorgeous, unbelievable, isolated, stunning landscape. I've seen condors there. Well, one of the three women, and I've known her since she was 10 or 11, so I could have this bantering time with her, she never looked up from her screen. At one point, she asked how much further it was to Cameron. Well, we just passed a mile marker, so I, the driver, was able to rapidly calculate up here how far it was. But right after she asked the question, she answered herself, saying, oh, look it up. We arrived at the answer at exactly the same moment. At which point, I couldn't resist asking her what she thought was going to happen to various mental skills and her mental acuity if she relied completely on her electronic devices. Then I said something probably borderline sarcastic about how she was missing life, missing the incredible country we were driving through. Which brings me to maps. I love maps. I love the feel of them. I love studying them. I love figuring out from the map how and where I'll explore a new city. I still have my maps of Paris and London and Athens and San Francisco and Portland, Oregon and other places where I've been. Discovering a place with the help of a map, an actual map, challenges us in a way that a digital navigational aid could never do. One way leads to knowledge, the other, which only requires taking in information passively, does the exact opposite. American philosopher Robert Tellis says that doing this kind of thing requires getting your hands dirty with the world and letting the world kick back in a certain way. The world is a messy place. Within that messiness, though, are tremendous opportunities and options. We can't reduce everything to a computer program. We can't automate everything. We can't solve all of the world's problems neatly and efficiently, which seems to be what Silicon Valley wants us to do. The question is, why would we want to do that? Last June, I had an entire day to explore Toronto, Canada. Yes, with my map. I walked for hours. I wandered into, someone had told me about this, a bank, a big commercial building in downtown Toronto, not an art museum or anything, but there was a collection of sculpture there done by Inuit people over the last 150 years ago. If you know anything about the Inuit people, you know that hunting has always been crucial to their lives. For 4,000 years, they've left their homes on the island of, and I'm probably not saying this right, Iglulik, off the coast of the Melville Peninsula in northeast Canada, to hunt. In the winter, in the Arctic, think ice and tundra. For most of these 4,000 years, they didn't have a GPS or any kind of navigational, satellite navigational aids. Now, the younger ones especially, almost all have GPSs, but they've completely skipped the training by the elders, which has led to injuries, deaths, and the loss, sadly, of what one Inuit elder calls the wisdom and knowledge of the Inuit. I suppose we could respond with a who cares attitude, but I think the Inuit story is a warning, a proceed with caution sign for humans. There's a big difference between learning a skill from the elders, you know, that getting hands-on experience, and blindly following a voice coming out of an electronic device. Another way to phrase this, there is a big difference between wayfaring and transport. The difference lies in which one lets us have the most interaction with the world. Research is showing that reading maps strengthens our sense of place, teaches us how to think spatially, gives us deeper knowledge about a place than GPS can, and may help keep our memories sharp. Nicholas Carr says that who we are is tangled up in where we are, which makes sense. So there are two ways to travel through life, in the wayfaring mode and in the transport mode. Wayfaring is an ongoing process in which we grow and develop and find ourselves renewed and refreshed. Transport is essentially destination-oriented, getting us from point A to point B. Wayfaring is messier and not as efficient as transporting. And there are times when transport mode is exactly what we need. But something's lost if you believe what Michael Jones, an executive in Google's mapping department, says about these two very different ways of travel. Jones says, you can go anywhere on the planet and have confidence that we being Google, can give you directions to get to where you want to go safely and easily. No human ever has to feel lost again. Whoa, I thought. I think Mr. Jones has no imagination. I liked what Nicholas Carr's response to this quote. The more you think about it, the more you realize that to never confront the possibility of getting lost is to live in a state of perpetual dislocation. If you never have to worry about not knowing where you are, then you never have to know where you are. If you never have to worry about not knowing where you are, then you never have to know where you are. Carr wonders, as do I, if that leaves us in a state of dependency, a ward of your phone and its apps. This also puts us in danger, I think, of forgetting something very important about being human. The journey is more important than the destination. After all, we all have the same destination. I want to be a wayfarer whenever possible. The journey through life is what matters. This is a very human thing. This understanding that the journey is that dash. You've heard this before, I think. Ministers have done whole sermons on this. The dash between our birth and death dates that truly defines who we are and why we are. Why are we so willing to outsource and offload our skills, our creativity, our imagination, our memory, our interaction with the world to computers and automation? There will probably be at least a part two to these reflections. We might consider search engines, for example, and their biases, or Facebook, and its, as Nicholas Carr puts it, automated management of many of the time-consuming aspects of personal relations in an attempt to streamline the messy process of affiliation and remove conscious effort from socializing. End of quote. One future Sunday, we might want to explore the concept of robots by asking questions like this: who will program the robot's conscience? The robot's manufacturer? Its owner? Software coders? Politicians? Government regulators? Philosophers? Insurance companies? In the meantime, those of us who call ourselves free thinkers should be very afraid of a world where computer use is seamless. That is, it's so ubiquitous, so everywhere, that we don't even realize it's there. And we should be hyper-vigilant, very worried about automation. For now, I'll just leave you with this fascinating example of automation from Evgeny Morozov's book, To Save Everything, Click Here. BinCam. How many of you have heard of BinCam? Well, it's a new project from researchers in Britain and Germany. Seeks to modernize how we deal with trash by making our bins smarter and, you guessed it, more social. Here's how it works. The bin's inside lid is equipped with a tiny smartphone that snaps a photo every time someone closes it. All of this, of course, in order to document what exactly you have just thrown away. A team of badly paid humans recruited through Amazon's Mechanical Turk system then evaluates each photo. What is the total number of items in the picture? How many of them are recyclable? How many are food items? After this data is attached to the photo, it's uploaded to the bin owner's Facebook account, where it can also be shared with other users. Once such smart bins are installed in multiple households, BinCam creators hope Facebook can be used to turn cycling into a game-like, exciting competition. A weekly score is calculated for each bin, and as the amounts of food waste and recyclable materials in the bins decrease, households earn. Yes, almost. Gold bars and leaves. Whoever wins the most bars and tree leaves wins. Mission accomplished. Planet saved. Now, nowhere in the academic paper that accompanies the BinCam presentation do the researchers raise any doubts about the ethics of their undoubtedly well-meaning project. Should we get one set of citizens to do the right thing by getting another set of citizens to spy on them? Should we introduce game incentives into a process that has previously worked through appeals to one's duties and obligations? Could the goodness of one's environmental behavior be accurately quantified with tree leaves and gold bars and stars? Should it be quantified in isolation from other everyday activities? Is it okay not to recycle if one doesn't drive? will greater public surveillance of one's trash bins lead to an increase in eco-vigilantism? Will participants stop doing the right thing if their Facebook friends are no longer watching? Closing words are those of Wayne Arneson's. Take courage, friends. The way is often hard. The path is never clear. And the stakes are very high. Take courage, for deep down there is another truth. You are not alone. Go in peace. Greet your neighbor. Drink coffee or whatever.